And now I would like to introduce today's opening speaker, Tina Elf.
I'm an alcoholic. My name's Tina.
Hi, Tina. We love you, Tina. Lots and lots and lots. And lots is wrong.
That is awesome. Can you do it again? No, I'm just kidding. By the grace of God, many, many, many God-graced people, I am sober today. And I want to thank Katie and Ryan for asking me to speak and their hospitality. Ryan, I know some of the speakers drive their cars over, get picked up at the airport and stuff, and Ryan's like, I'll drive over to your house, give me the address. And he said, do you want to ride your Harley? I'm like, heck yeah, let's get on the bike and go. So he came over yesterday to the house. I live over on the other side of the mountain. And we suited up and we rode over here on the motorcycles. I'm like, but wait, I'm wearing a dress. How is that going to work? So anyways, see, when I was drinking, I wouldn't have cared. Because that's just how I rolled. But anyways, he drove the truck today so I could wear a dress. Because I do suit up and show up. I don't wear a dress very often, but I do wear a dress. Nobody tells me how to dress in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't need to wear a dress to talk to newcomers. But I wear a dress because I've learned how to become a lady in this program. That's why. And my sobriety date is March 26th, 1989. I got sober when I was 25 years old, and I celebrated 25 years of sobriety this year, so I have been sober a lifetime, just like Teresa was last night. And that's kind of weird. You know, it's weird. I don't know how to identify it. It just is kind of different. And anyways, I know I'm out of time, 15 minutes, so I'll try to, like, scoop all this stuff in real quick. I drank because I like the effect produced by alcohol. It's as simple as that for me. I came from a normal family. They didn't drink. They didn't do drugs. And here I was and started high school. I'm like, ooh, beer. Yeah, I like it. I like the taste of it. I like the way it made me feel. I liked the effect of it. It made me feel 10 feet tall and bulletproof. It made me a little bit taller, a little bit slimmer, a little bit bigger. And so that's what happened. Alcohol got in the way of my schooling. I dropped out of high school when I was 17 and I got pregnant. And I'm going to share this with you because it's part of my story. It's only by the grace of God that my child was normal because I drank during that pregnancy. And he was a 9-pound baby. He was my gift. And a couple years after he was like 2 or 3 years old, I couldn't take care of him because of my drinking. So my parents took custody of him, and that landed me on the streets of Phoenix. I drank. That's where I was born and raised, was in Phoenix. I bartended at the Crazy Horse Saloon. It used to be on 19th Avenue and Cactus. It was run by motorcycle enthusiasts. We'll just put it that way. You know how you guys are saying, I'm from the west side, I'm from the east side. It's kind of like Hell's Angels, Vagos. Just like that, you know. So that's all I'm saying about that. And it was run by some motorcycle enthusiasts, and that's where I really got into drinking. My alcoholism progressed on me very, very quickly. It talks about it in the big book. That I think it's on page 33. I don't quote the big book, but I'll paraphrase this for you. You don't have to drink the quantities that we have or as long as we have. Alcohol progresses on women very, very quickly. And that's what happened to me. I was kind of a badass when I got here. But alcohol had kicked my ass. And it almost brought me into the gates of insanity and death. And when I was 24 years old, I got into a really bad accident down in Phoenix. I thought I drank myself sober. Impossible. Impossible. And I ended up in some ditch, I guess. And I came to and I was in the hospital. My dad was on one side of me and the trauma surgeon was on the other side. And he said, if you keep doing what you're doing, I give you your live. Do you want help? I'm like, really? I'm 24. No, I don't want help. A year later, my dad had me arrested. He did an intervention. We all have our own bottoms here. Whatever your bottom is your bottom. And my dad did an intervention on me, had me arrested down in Phoenix. I was doing some horrible, horrible crime down there. Had me arrested, shipped me up to Flagstaff to the guidance center, and he said, if you don't get sober, he goes, don't ever call us again, because you're killing our family. Well, this, I believe, is a disease of self. We're selfish and self-centered. Why don't you just leave me alone? I'm drinking, I'm not hurting anybody, blah, blah, blah. Well, we all know that's not true, because this disease affects everybody around us. And I'm like, okay, whatever. I was looking at 5 years in prison if I didn't get sober. I don't know if they have it anymore. It's called the Task Diversion Program. I was on that in 1989, and that program introduced me to Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not plan on staying here. I was hips looking cool when I got here. I was young. I was badass, I thought. And I was going to do probation and keep... And as soon as I got out of probation, I was going to jam back down to Phoenix and hang out with the people I was hanging out with. That didn't happen. Something happened in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. You can call it a burning bush. You can call it a spiritual experience. I heard someone tell pretty much my story, and it was a young woman. There wasn't a lot of young people when I got sober. They were all old-timers that pretty much took me under their wing. And they're like, this is what you're going to do. You're going to mop. You're going to wash ashtrays. You're going to wash coffee cups. I'm like, okay, whatever. I'll just do this until I'm done doing it. And I kept coming back. They go, keep coming back. And you know what? I started changing. I grabbed a sponsor, and she took me through the steps. And I started changing in spite of myself. I didn't wake up every day and say, I'm going to not be a liar, cheat, and a thief. I just didn't. I didn't do that, because that's what I was when I got here. And I was a low-bottom drunk. I was living on the streets of Phoenix on 19th Avenue and Cactus. Yeah, I think you guys call it couch surfing now. Back then it was homelessness. You find out whoever's couch you want to live on, and when they're done with you, they'll kick you out next. And so that's what I did. And, you know, Teresa was saying it last night, some of us look good on the outside. When we got here, I was very young. And I still kind of look good on the outside, but I was dying on the inside. I did not know that I was an alcoholic, because I had a preconceived idea that alcoholics were old men, trench coats, paper bags, Skid Row. And someone, an old timer, said, what happens to you when you drink? I said, I can't freaking stop. I'm a blackout drinker. I come to, I don't know who the hell I'm sleeping with. It's like, whoa, what is your name? Look out the window. Wait, you're on a Honda? Oh, what happened? Whoa, oh, what happened? What just happened there? He goes, what happens when you drink? And they explained to me that you have a mental obsession coupled with a physical allergy. The obsession of the mind, the allergy of the body. And that's what happened. When I drank, the phenomenon of craving set in, and I couldn't stop. I couldn't tell you what was going to happen. I couldn't tell you what I would do. Nothing like that. And that made sense to me. And the light bulb went on. So this lady took me through the steps, and I started changing in spite of myself, and life started happening quick. Because I followed direction. My home group is We're Nautical and Lot on Sunday night. I've had a home group the entire time I've been sober. I've had commitments. I have a sponsor. I sponsor. They sponsor. And we all kind of congregate together. You know, kind of like you guys. This is amazing. I love young people in sobriety, because I got sober when I was young. And anyway, so I started taking the steps, started changing in spite of myself, and things started happening. I didn't have a car when I got here. I didn't have custody of my son. I didn't have money. I didn't have family. I didn't have anything. So a couple years sober, I got a job and saved up $500, and I bought my first car in sobriety. It was a Pinto. Yeah. It's like a 1972 Pinto. The window didn't go up. The door didn't shut. The defroster didn't work. It was a total drunk car. But you know what? I was okay with it, because it was mine. You know, I bought it with real, honest money. I didn't have to steal. And I was offered a job in Southern California. So I picked up my stuff, and I jammed over there. And man, they got, if you want a hotbed for Alcoholics Anonymous, go to San Diego. Well, that place will rock your world. And anyways, so life is getting better and better. I jumped into Alcoholics Anonymous, got some commitments, suited up and showed up for my job. And 3 years sober, I 13th stepped a guy. 90 days later, we got married. And so check this out. We got married. You know, I was always told, keep it simple. Keep it simple, keep it simple. So we called some guy in the phone book, some minister dude, and we're like, hey, check it out. We're getting married. And we jammed back over here to Cottonwood because my parents and my son lived in Cornville. And, you know, I thought, okay, well, I've never been married. I was too sick to have any kind of relationship in Alcoholics Anonymous before I met Doug or before I even got sober. I was never married. I was too sick. Anyway, so the guy's like, okay, meet me at mile 293 at the bottom of Bell Rock. Bring $100. So we're like, okay, cool. So we did. And you know what? It was simple. It was spiritual. And it was to the point. We got married. And I'm still married 21 years later. So. AA relationships do work, just saying. Anyways, where it says, people say, don't be in a relationship in the first year. Please show me where it says that in this big book. Okay. Anyway, so I got married. Me and my husband had I was working up corporate ladder. He had a great job, and my dad called me at 5 years sober, and he said, you can have custody of your son back, but not in a big city. We're like, how are we going to make a living in Cottonwood, Arizona, doing what we do in Southern California? But you know what? We prayed about it, did some footwork, and my husband was offered a job in Cottonwood, and so we moved back to Cottonwood, Arizona. I got custody of my son back. Awesome. You know, so those are the things that started happening in my sobriety. I had nothing when I got here, and I was employable. I got a car. I got married. I got my son back. And it's all because I stayed in the middle of this thing. I stayed in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a great, great deal that we have here. And if you don't leave before the miracle happens. You know, that we always hear that. Don't leave before the miracle happens. And I don't. And I haven't. And so anyways, we moved back to Cottonwood, and he went through high school, and we found jobs, blah, blah, blah. And in the year 2000, he went in the military, and we moved back to San Diego. We were kind of done here. You know, we both got transferred back over there. I was in corporate America again, working for a big corporation. My husband was in heavy construction, and I love Roundups. We are Roundup junkies, me and my husband. And we do a lot of Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. We do a lot of Roundups. Anywhere I go, I try to find an AA meeting and a Harley Davidson shop. So anyways, my son and his wife got stationed over in Germany, and I flew over to Germany. First thing I did was found an AA meeting on base and found a Harley Davidson shop in Germany, because that's what I do. You know, this program was given to me so freely, and it asked very little from me. It asked me to suit up and show up, trust God, clean house, help others. That's what it asked me to do. And anyway, so I try to do that. And, you know, Teresa was saying it last night, just because we get sober doesn't mean I'm going to be on Bell Rock in Sedona doing OM because I'm some friggin' like some kind of guru, because that's not what happens. Life happens. In 2007, we were at a round of the tri-state in Laughlin, and my company got sold. I worked in a title and escrow, and housing market was booming. The economy was booming for a while, and then it took a dump in 2007. And I knew I was getting laid off because my department that I managed got transferred over to India. But that was okay. You know, I knew God had another plan. So we went to a tri-state, and then we went to Disneyland, me and my husband, another couple, just being crazy. And a couple weeks later, the phone rang. It was Sunday night, and it was 10 o'clock, and this lady was on the other line. And she said, are you Tina Lombardi? I said, yes. And she said, this is Major Romero with the United States Air Force in the Ramstein, Germany. Your son was killed. And I'm like, what? Okay, so this was the weird part, is that it didn't make sense because it was Monday. She said Monday, but it was Sunday. So I'm like, this has to be a mistake because I couldn't line up the, you know, the whole time thing or whatever. And my daughter-in-law was over in Germany, and that's, you know, when the men in the uniform come up with the red folders on knock on your door, you know you're screwed. So that's what happened over there. That's the phone call I got. First thing I did, after I went into shock, I called my sponsor. The next thing I did was call all the girls that I sponsored. They became my sponsor because I was in shock. I couldn't drive. They got me to my home group the next day. And some people were shocked. What are you doing here? I can't believe you're here. I'm here because this is what I was taught to do. I had 18 years sober. Did not think of drinking. So after we moved from San Diego, because, you know, the jobs were, you know, gone, and now my son was killed, and we moved to Flagstaff because my husband was offered another job, and my daughter-in-law moved with us. She, you know, I went to Germany after my son was killed and got, tried to get his affairs and everything in order. And the first thing I did was go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous on base, and didn't think of drinking. You know, that's a God thing. That is a God thing. And it's because I believe it. I've been in the middle of this thing. And anyway, so we went up to Flag and got my daughter-in-law situated, and for a year she lived with us, and then she went out on her own. She went to NAU and got her degree, and me and my husband moved to Lake Havasu because he couldn't breathe up there. So his employer sent him to Lake Havasu, and it was quiet in our house because my husband traveled a lot for his jobs, and our daughter-in-law was in Flagstaff, and I sat there, I'm like, what the hell just happened? You know, I finally got some quiet time. And I was doing meetings, I was sponsoring, I was praying. But I had an obsession that I wanted to be with Keith, my son. So I got this fun little job, something to keep my mind busy, because I don't have to work right now. And I got a job at this little concession store in the river. I rode my motorcycle, wore shorts. I'm like, this is cool. It's like a no-brainer. You know, I sell freaking alcohol and cigarettes to people with big boats, you know, that are on vacation. So they pretty much were all happy. Something happened where it's like 19 years sober. I was riding to work, and I got so freaking sad and overwhelmed that Parker Dam was this way, my work was that way. Every day I thought about riding my motorcycle off the cliff. That's how bad it got. My sponsor's like, you need to get freaking riding. Get riding. So I got riding at 20 years sober. I did another third step. He took me through the steps again. And I did writing, and it was instant relief. I'm telling you, I did a fourth step on the whole thing, fifth, sixth, seventh. I do not obsess about my son being dead anymore. I think about him once in a while. Certain things help me think about him, but it's not like this weird obsession. So when you hear about old-timers offing themselves, it's because I believe that something's lagging. I know because I almost did it. I almost offed myself. I almost rode my motorcycle off the cliff. And that didn't happen. And, you know, so I'm not ashamed of saying I still take the steps at 20 years sober with a sponsor. And 2010, you know, I hated my dad for a while because how could you have me arrested? Oh, boo-hoo, you know. We became very close. You know, I made amends to my dad, my mom, and my son. And I don't have any regrets about, I wish I would have said this to my son. I wish I would have done that. So when they say, as some of these we bought, I didn't. And I'm grateful for that today because I don't have any guilt about any of that stuff. Me and my son were super cool and super close and had a really good relationship. And so did me and my dad. I got a call from my dad. He goes, well, I'm dying. He goes, I have 4 months to live. I'm like, okay. So me and my husband packed up from Lake Havasu when we moved over here to Cornville. And, you know, I was able to be present for my dad's death. And not all drunk and passed out and come to, and I was able to be there for him. and he died. He died a couple 4 years ago. And then my sponsor at 20 years also passed away 4 years ago. So I'm like, all these people are dying. I have a very, very small family, but I come to Alcoholics Anonymous and I have this huge family and it's awesome. I can go anywhere in the world and find an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting because I've done it. I've been in 9 different countries in sobriety. Not on a bar stool going, oh yeah, I'm going to go here, go there, and not go anywhere. Taking a trip, not taking a trip, that whole thing. You know, I've done all that stuff in sobriety. And last year, my husband and his sponsor friend went on a 4,000-mile motorcycle trip. And they came back, and a couple weeks later, we were supposed to come over to Prescott and meet some friends over here for breakfast. So I woke him up and went in the other room. I'm like, what is he doing? It's like 20 minutes later. Well, I go back in there, and he's laying on the floor, half dead. And he goes, call 911, I'm having a stroke. I'm like, what? What the heck? Where's the phone? You know, he's like, so I called 911, and he was half dead. You know, his whole right side was paralyzed, and he was in a nursing home for 2 months. He couldn't walk, couldn't talk. But you know what I did? I called my sponsor, got to a meeting, got to my home group. And so that's what sobriety, that's what I've experienced in sobriety. I'm going over my time, sorry. That's what I've experienced in sobriety. I have taken the steps. I believe the first 3 steps are getting right with God. 4 through 7 are getting right with ourselves. 8 and 9 are getting right with our fellow man. I don't look over my shoulder anymore today. I don't look over my shoulder like, oh, did I sleep with your husband? Or did I sleep with you? Or did I rip you off? Or it talks about in the big book, we're free man. We're free. I am free today. I am free today. And it's a result of taking the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Finding a God in here that I can do business with. I believe my higher power is a recovering alcoholic and rides a Harley. I don't know, it works for me. You know, get whatever you can. Get whatever you can. It really doesn't friggin' matter. All I know is I have a power greater than myself that I choose today to call God, and I can do business with him. And that's a big, big deal. They say there are no big deals in Alcoholics Anonymous. Bullshit. You know, this is a big deal that a bunch of young people are sitting here on a Sunday morning at a speaker meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know how freaking cool that is. That's awesome. And last night was amazing. The energy and the fervor in the room last night was incredible. And I really, really hope the young people stay here and just give this thing a chance. Give it a chance. It doesn't matter. It talks about, you know, I said, it doesn't matter how much you drank or the quantities you drank or how far down. It doesn't matter. Your bottom is your bottom. And I'm super, super grateful that you guys asked me to speak. And I see you guys next year. Thank you.
Thank you, Tina. And now please help me welcome Scott W. Yeah.
Hi everybody, I'm Scott, I'm an alcoholic.
We love you, Scott. We love you, Scott. Lots and lots and lots. And whoa.
I love that. I've been waiting for that all weekend. My Eskimo, the guy that helped me get sober, that would have just drove him crazy. I used to do that to him. In meetings after I got sober, I was a little smart ass, you know, and I would do, you know, little comments, and it would just send him spinning. So I was just hoping that he could have been here, because that would have sent him through the roof. But can everybody hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay. So just what a fantastic weekend this has been. The energy is incredible. I want to thank Kendra for inviting me to speak, and the the work that you guys have done on this committee and putting this together is amazing. And that kind of service work will just, you know, do you so much good in your sobriety. That's the deal here, being of service. I'm glad there's not 1,050 people here like last night. I'm supposed to be the spiritual speaker. Probably the only spiritual thing about me is my t-shirt. And, you know, just, I'm so impressed with what you guys are doing with this conference. And the way you guys laugh and support each other, it's just incredible. And there's a lot of you here in the room that I saw you the day you came in. And it's just, that's the joy for me to see that you're all still here. So I'm just going to, I don't have a fixed pitch, so I'm just going to go ahead and kind of say what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I burned the toast twice in 1 week, and I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and my life's been great ever since. Thanks for letting me share. It was a little worse than that. But let me back up to my sobriety date is August 18th, 1997. I had the pleasure to go over to the Crazy Birds group yesterday morning at 7 o'clock and take a chip with my friend Rex and New York Jimmy. I'm really grateful to them because I was being held hostage by the federal government one time. And New York Jimmy and Steve K and Rex used to bring me the message down there. And I would be like, you know, I think Steve had 46, 47 years sober at that time. And I was like, why do you come down here and do this? You got like 47 years. What's wrong with you? And they were like, how do you think we got 47 years, stupid? So I thought before getting in recovery that I grew up in a normal family. What I've come to know now that when it comes to families, that normal's a setting on the washing machine. There's no such thing. I went to a private Christian school, and my mom was the PE teacher at my school. And I had, my brother was 11 years older than me. I had a sister 9 years older than me and another sister 5 years older than me. And I remember in sixth grade, I came home from school one day and my mom wasn't around. So I asked my older sister, Chris, I said, where's mom? And she goes, well, she found out Dad was having an affair on her, and her and the preacher of your school ran away to Reno together. And I was like, oh, you just gave me a resentment. And I was pissed off at God, pissed off at organized religion, pissed off at my mom, pissed off at this preacher, pissed off at my dad. And I know it's hard to believe with my long hair, I mean my blonde hair, but this was back in the late 60s, and my siblings were older than me, and they were all experimenting with all kinds of stuff. That they, I think on page 22, it calls it strong sedatives and morphine and things like that. And so I embarked on a career of, I'm going to drink and use at you for, you know, the abandonment and all that. And I've come to find out now that, you know, being in recovery, that it wasn't my mom's fault. It's not my dad's fault that I'm an alcoholic. It's not anybody's fault. Maybe it's a little genetic in my family. My grandma was an alcoholic. She'd go back in the, you know, 40s and 50s. They sent you to the psych ward instead of to treatment like they do do nowadays. And she hated AA for that. She never got sober. They would force her to go to AA, and she hated it. And so I have a long history of addiction and alcoholism in my family. So I started on my, I had my first drink in sixth grade, and man, it just hit me like, you know, this is it. This, the feelings of abandonment and feeling less than, it took that away. I became sociable. And it's a miracle I'm up here speaking today. When I first got in the rooms, I would read How It Works and have like a panic attack, like bad. And the guys I got sober with would love it. They'd be like, oh, goody, he's going to read. He's going to have a panic attack. We get to watch him. And they even made me a brown paper bag with a label on it in case of panic attack, open bag. And they just got a kick out of it. But I was told when I got here, do whatever is asked of you to do service-wise, and you're going to get to stay sober. So I pushed through it, you know, and I pushed through it, and I pushed through it, and, it's gotten less. So I drank a lot, did a lot of drugs, and when I was 14, I was pretty out of control, doing a lot of drinking, a lot of drugging. My mom, it took me, this is another thing, it took me a while to, you know, through working through the steps with a sponsor, she was a housewife of the 50s and 60s, and when she got a divorce, women back then had no education, they stayed home and took care of the kids, so she didn't know how to do nothing. And so she married this man for security. And I was living with her and this man. And one day I came back to the house and my mom told me that this man had tried to molest my 4-year-old niece. And my best friend was a guy older than me, a Native American guy, and we used to drink together on the res. Anybody ever drink on the res? It's pretty wild. His mom used to come behind the liquor store in the morning and say, are you okay? And I'd say, yeah, I'm okay, Miss Diaz. And she'd be like, you better watch out. These Indians gonna kill your white ass. So anyway, me and my friend went over there and we hurt this guy pretty bad and put him in the hospital. And when he got out, he kicked me out of his house for beating him up. Can you imagine that? Really? And what gave me a big resentment was that my mom stayed with him. And it took me a long time to get over that. And so, you know, I dropped out of high school. I never made it to high school, I think. Back then, you went to high school in 10th grade, so 9th grade I dropped out. So, but I did have a little, I had a little career. I was selling marijuana down at the high school parking lot. And I knew this family that grew marijuana. This was in Palm Springs, California, and they grew marijuana up in high desert and in Oregon, and they would front me, you know, all this weed. But the problem was I became my own best customer. And then I like to spend some of the money that I should be giving to them back for getting front on this weed. I would buy some cocaine and some heroin and things like that. And so by the time I was 17, I was drinking so much that I would have to get a big glass of vodka in the morning with a little bit of tomato juice for color, because, you know, I'm a gentleman. And I was shaking so bad I would have to either get a straw or I would sip it off the table like this. So after I had about two of those, then I could drink regularly for the rest of the day and the rest of the night, and I didn't sleep much. And these people were starting to want their money pretty bad. So I did a geographical and I moved down to Orange County, California. Must be somebody from OC in the house. I see you. And you know, I drank and I used. That's what I did. And also, I'm the kind of alcoholic that will steal your wallet and help you look for it. I've done that. I'll steal your drugs and help you look for it. And so Tina brought up the thing about the Pinto. I had this Pinto station wagon with the wood on the side. And this is the only time I got arrested for it. I was innocent this time. Me and this kid were driving around drinking, and he wanted to get some cigarettes, and we pulled into this gas station in Oceanside, and the gas station was closed. He broke the window, and there was an armed security guard inside of there with a shotgun. So the kid comes running back to the car. He's like, "Go, go, go!" And I look, and here's this armed security guard with a shotgun. I duck. He blows my window out. Didn't get hit. Seconds and inches. And then he shot my tire out. I got down the road into the alley, and then the cops came, and I got arrested. And I thought I had a warrant, so, you know, I'm going to use my brother's name. That way I can get out of jail faster. So anyway, I ended up getting like 4 months for that, and assault with a deadly Pinto wagon. Took a plea deal. And I went back to Orange County, and, you know, by this time I'm about 20, and I felt guilty about using my brother's name, so my aunt's, you know, solution to that is I'm just not going to talk to my family anymore. So I didn't talk to my family for like 2 years, and my poor mom, she's just worried to death. She was going around with pictures of me down in Palm Springs. Have you seen this man? And, you know, the things we put our family through with this disease is just incredible. You know, that's why it's called a family disease, because the things we do affect everybody. And every time I would do those things, it was like flushing another piece of my soul down the toilet. You know, every time I stole from you, lied to you, all that. And so I'm back in Orange County after my little four-month stint, which seemed like forever to me. And my sisters and my brother-in-law showed up where I was living. I was like, how the hell did they find me? And then I'm thinking, well, gee, something bad must have happened. Grandma must have died. And I went outside, and I'm like, hey, what are you guys doing here? And they go, well, we got some bad news. And I'm thinking, well, my grandma, the alcoholic, finally drank too much, you know. And they said, your brother, my brother Craig, is dead. And, you know, my brother was the old hippie guy with the John Lennon glasses and the long hair, and he had the fringe jacket, and he went to Haight-Ashbury. Hey, man. Just take some acid, man. He would call my mom, man. And this is why, and this is only my opinion, marijuana is dangerous. My brother came down from Washington, and he was going to work for my dad, and he was a little bit smoked out. And he got on an aluminum ladder with no shoes on. The cement slab was wet from the day before. It had rained. My dad had told him to turn off the power before he drilled these holes in the ceiling, and he didn't, and he hit a hot wire, and it electrocuted him. And my dad came back from the lumber yard and found my brother, you know, pretty much burned up from being electrocuted. Pretty ugly, I think. And basically, my dad died of a broken heart after that. He died of a stroke a few years after that happened. And so my sisters and brother-in-law are there, and they're like, you know, we need to go down and support mom and dad in Palm Springs and go to the funeral. And I was like, okay, I'm in for that. And we stopped in Santa Ana and got a bunch of alcohol and some drugs and some strong sedatives and opiates and cocaine and things like that. And I went to my my brother's funeral, just wiped out, you know, just totally disrespectful to him. But that's what we do. We have no, that is our coping skills, is to drink and use. And went through the funeral and, you know, went back to Orange County. I had actually kind of, in my mind, it was like, oh, I'm kind of straightened up now. I had a job. I was working as a mechanic at this place, and I went back to work there, and I didn't know how to deal with this grief, you know, and I started drinking more. I started using more, and things got bad, and I was, you know, they made the big mistake of letting me be in charge when I would do it like a brake job or rebuild a front end or a front end alignment. I would be the guy that got to help the customer at the register. So rather than put the cash in the till and fill out a receipt, I'd fill out like a bogus receipt, you know, or keep the triplicate and stuff in my pocket and the money in my pocket. So, you know, that didn't go over too good with my boss, and I ended up losing that job. So for just a couple of years, I was, you know, staying at one sister's house. I'd go to another sister's house. They were getting tired of me. And, you know, and they're both heroin addicts. So, you know, you're getting pretty bad when the heroin addicts want to kick you out of their house, right? That's like, you're getting towards the bottom. So at about 24, I'm living in my car, and I'm, you know, just miserable, shaking. I'm out of money. I had a dollar's worth of gas left in my car. And I used to read the Orange County Register all the time. And they always had all these, you know, like in the crime blog, there'd be like bank robbery, bank robbery, bank robbery. But I would never read where they caught any of these people. So I was like, this shit must be easy. I gotta try this. So I'm sick and shaky, you know, and I get a manila envelope and I write a note and I shake myself in, you know, into this bank, and I'm standing in line waiting to make my withdrawal. And I hand the teller my little note, and she looks at me and eyes get kind of big, and then I go put it in here, manila envelope, so she starts putting it in there. And then the last little, she gave me a little wrap, you know, the money with the wrapper on it. She stuck one of those in there and kind of gave me a look like, here, take this, you son of a bee. And I walk out, and as soon as I get out the door, the whole dang thing exploded. It was one of those exploding dye packs. Scared me to death. I thought somebody shot me and burnt my hand. Money's coming out of the sky like a ticker tape parade. Everybody's looking at me in the parking lot. This is like in Santa Ana. There's a lot of cops and law enforcement around there, and I'm like, man. Well, I'm not doing all this for nothing. I stopped and I picked up like $1,500, got my car, and got away. And I was like, man, I made it. And I headed to the Connection and the liquor store. And then I went and got a hotel. And, you know, the big book talks about, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but they talk about we can't even remember the misery of a week ago. So once that, the $1,500 does not last long when you're drinking and using like I was. So it was like, it lasted like 2.5-3 days. And then I'm thinking, gee, you know, that wasn't so bad. You know, that wasn't so bad. Money blowing up, you know. I got to try that again, but this time I'm like, I'm going to tell them not to give me the exploding dye pack. And that's what I did. So I kind of turned into like this a serial bank robber. And every, you know, as soon as I would run out of money, sometimes I'd get pretty good load. I was only doing one teller, so, you know, sometimes you get 3,000, sometimes 5, sometimes 10. And so after about 6 or 8 of those, I was going to go get some. I was a little sleepy, so I needed some cocaine. And I called my cocaine connection. I said, hey, I need to pick up. And he's like, yeah, come on over. And I get there and he says, hey, it's over at my mom's house. Can you give me a ride over to get it? And I'm like, sure, get in. And this was back in the days before cell phones. This was like 1986. And he says, stop at this 7-Eleven. I got to use the phone. And I pull into the 7-Eleven. We get out to go to the payphone, and about 500 FBI agents just came out of the woodwork, and they threw me down on the ground, and that was it. They had me, and they took him away. He had turned me in, so those drug dealer guys aren't very trustworthy. They have no integrity, those people. So what happened was, at 25 years old, I was in. They only indicted me for 2 bank robberies. I don't know why they do that, but they did. So I wasn't mad about it. And at 25 years old, I was sentenced to 28 years in federal prison. And I about fell off the chair because, you know, that was more time than I'd been on this earth at that point. And then the judge said, I'm going to suspend the 20 years. And if I see you come back in my courtroom, you're going to get this 20. And, you know, you would think that would be enough for you to say, like, I'm not doing this anymore. I've got a problem. And I was like, yes, sir. And they put me on the little Conair jet, and I ended up in a little place called Bastrop, Texas, south of Austin. And I got there, and there was more alcohol and drugs in there than there is out here. And I should have only done about 4 years on that 8-year sentence. Back then they had parole. And I would get dirty UAs and dirty breathalyzers and go to the hole for 60 days and get 200 days good time they would take. And it was just insane. And there was... never heard of AA up to this. There was no meetings in there. I don't know what that says for the Bureau of Prisons back then, but so I ended up doing 7 years on an 8-year sentence, and I got on the plane, got out, had to go back to Long Beach on a plane. And that was weird because I remember I had a layover in Phoenix, and I went in to wash my hands, use the bathroom, and when I washed my hands, I was at the sink and there's no handles, and I'm just standing there like, where's the handles? And this guy says, hey, stupid, put your hands under there, it'll come on automatically. But I had never seen that before, so it was a little bit of culture shock there. So I got out, went to Long Beach. My sister picked me up and she says, I thought you were supposed to get healthy in there. You look worse than when you went in. I was like, well, it's a little rough in there. And my niece, who was 11 years younger than me, she was 20. She had gone to treatment. And so she asked me, hey, would you want to go to the A&A meeting? And I'm like, what's that? And she says, well, it's a group of alcoholics that aren't drinking anymore, and they found a way not to drink, and would you like to go? And I'm like, you know, she was my favorite person in the world, my little niece. And I said, sure, I'll go with you. And so we went, and the first thing I started hearing when they read how it works is God, God, God. And I'm like, oh, I know what these people are about. They're a bunch of religious fanatics, and, you know, I don't do religion because my mom ran away to Reno with the preacher of my private Christian school. I'm not doing that. And, they said, get a sponsor too. And I'm like, oh, yeah. I've had people tell me what to do for the past 7 years. I'm not getting some sponsor that's going to tell me what to do. I got to catch up here. So somehow or another, I would go to one meeting a week, whether I needed it or not. And I didn't need this God thing you talked about, and I didn't get a sponsor. And I put together like a year like that, just white knuckling it, you know. And I looked good. I looked good on the outside. I had a good job and, you know, was making my parole officer meetings and testing clean. And I had a bright idea to go to the AA convention down in Palm Springs where I grew up by myself. Horrible idea. Alcoholic new in recovery going anywhere by themselves. And the big book talks about there'll come a time when you have no defense against that first drink. That defense must come from a power greater than yourself. And I drove my car all the way down to Palm Springs, and that little voice said, hey, you can go have a drink and nobody will ever know. And I had no defense once that thought hit me. And the phenomenon of craving set in that they talk about in the doctor's opinion once I had that first drink. And I couldn't stop. I'm the kind of alcoholic that once I start, I will not stop until you put me in a cage. I won't go to treatment. There's nothing that will stop me. Either a cage or death. This is the only thing that will stop me. And so within 4 months, you would think, wait a minute, dummy, you've got a 20-year suspended prison sentence here. But lack of power, that's my dilemma. I had no higher power to help me in this. And I was too prideful to go back into those, you know, one of my one meetings a week that I went to and say, hey, I relapsed. Can I get some help? I didn't know how to ask for help. I don't ask for help. So in 1996, about December, you know, I couldn't test for this parole guy. I couldn't make it to work on time. You know, I was coming into work at like 1 o'clock, and I do what I do. I'm gonna run. I gotta go on the run. And so I started robbing banks again. And I went on about another 8 or 9 bank robbery spree. And then, thank God, my nephew got busted for shoplifting and didn't want to do 3 days. And he turned me into the FBI. And one more time, I was in handcuffs. And that gave me a big resentment at first, believe it or not. But after I got in the program, I realized he saved my life. Because I was killing myself. I was going to die. I was going to get shot by the police or something bad was going to happen to me. It's a miracle that I'm even here. So I'm in big trouble now. They charge me as a unarmed career criminal. And by the way, they called, you know, down in L.A., they name all the bank robbers. And my grandma was French and taught me to have good manners. So I would always say please and thank you when I did my little withdrawals at the bank. So they named me the gentleman bank robber. So I'm in big trouble. They charged me as an unarmed career criminal. And the feds had changed their sentencing deal. Ronald Reagan got rid of parole. So now they had this chart that said, your criminal history is this, you did this, you're going to get between this much and this much time. And for me, it was 151 to 210 months. So I'm thinking, man, I got to make some kind of deal, because if I get that and I get this 20-year suspended sentence and they run it bow-legged, they call it, consecutive, where you have to do one first and then the other. I'm going to be about the age I am now, 80 years old when I get out. So I told my public defender, public pretender, I call him. I said, look, tell them, they only indicted me for one bank because I think they were still like investigating, what did this guy do? I said, tell them I will plead guilty to one bank robbery. Anything you give me out of the 20-year suspended sentence, you run concurrent. I'll take the 151 months, the bottom of the guidelines. And I will tell you all the banks that I robbed so that you're, looks like you're solving crime, but don't indict me for them. And they did it. So I went to sentencing and I got 151 months, which is like 13 years. And the 20-year suspended sentence, they gave me five off out of it, and that was it. So, and luckily the judge that I had before had passed away. So, morbid, but hey. So I get, they told me, you know, you've been around a time or two now, and we're not going to send you to this nice little club-fed place where you went before with the tennis courts and the salad bar and the free-flowing beverages in the chow hall. They had soda machines in there, like Circle K. I was like, this ain't bad. We're going to send you to the United States Penitentiary Maximum Security in Lompoc, California. And that's where I went. And I got up there, and man, did they have a lot of drugs and alcohol going on up at that place. It was like, this is great. You know, and I got in the mix as soon as I got there. High the first day, drunk the first day. And I could never understand up there that these drug dealers they have up there, they're in organizations like Mexican Mafia and the Aryan Brotherhood and stuff. They will let you get like $3,000 or $4,000 in debt, but you only make like at the most, if you're like working overtime, like $300 a month. So how are you going to let somebody get that far in debt? It was incredible. So I was starting to get into debt to these people, and things weren't looking good. And here's the part where I like to say that the devil drove me into AA. Now the committee's looking at Kendra like, Kendra, he's talking about the devil. He's supposed to be the spiritual. Get him out of here. They're not going to have you on here. I like to say the devil drove me into AA and God kept me here. And I was asleep in my cell. Had just got out of the hole that day. August 17th, 1997. Got drunk, got high. They usually come and do count at 4 o'clock and then they let you out after that. And they didn't open the door. And what happened was a friend of mine had gotten, they put a mentally challenged guy in his cell and the guy heard voices and killed this guy, strangled him and wrapped him up in a blanket and put him under the bed. So they were having this investigation. We didn't get out for count after count. And I said, hey, if something happened, I'm just going to go to sleep. In the middle of the night, I wake up this yellow basketball size, like ball of light, like a yellow evil presence woke me up. It was like hovering in my cell. And I was like, what in the F is that? And it scared me to death. And I couldn't go back to sleep. That night I was thinking, man, if I could believe in something that evil, I should have tried believing in that higher power stuff those stupid AA people are always talking about, and I might not be in this situation. So that was the devil part. Next morning they racked the gates. I'm going to go bum some coffee because why would I buy my own coffee? I need to spend my money on drugs, so I'm going to drink your coffee. I walk down the second tier and I look in this guy's cell and there's a big book sitting on his locker. And I knew that book because I went to one meeting a week whether I needed it or not when I was out there. And he was standing there and I says, "Hey, is that your book?" And he goes, "Yeah." And I go, "Do they have those meetings here?" And he says, "Yeah, they do. Would you like to go with me? They have one tonight." And I said, "Yeah, I'll go with you." And that was that little bit of willingness that Teresa was talking about last night. That little bit of willingness. And I went to my first meeting that night. And at that time, there was only about 6 or 8 guys. And thank God, the person that was facilitating the meetings, the staff member, was a member of AA. And he's my sponsor today. Great man. But, so we had this little meeting, and, you know, I was really open-minded that I don't know what it was about that yellow ball of light, but it woke me up. And so, started going to meetings in there. There were 6 or 8 of us. It talks about it in the big book that you'll see a fellowship grow up about you. These are things you don't want to miss. And I got to do that in there. We started out with 6 or 8 guys. Then it got 15 guys. And then it got 20 guys. And then it got to where we had to get a bigger room. And I was, you know, hearing about doing service. I would show up to the meetings an hour early and I would make coffee and set up chairs and I would stay after and I'd pick up chairs and mop the floor. And I would hear all this stuff from, like, on speaker tapes and everything. And from this man, Lee C. And then we started getting a Saturday meeting once a month that we would have a speaker come up. And we started getting, like, Clancy and Earl H. and Bob D. from Las Vegas and Karen G. And these are, like, these fantastic speakers, you know, that speak at the big conferences, like, you know, just dynamic people, like, you know, like Teresa's dynamic. And the joke used to be that if you want to get sober and see circuit speakers, you'd rob a bank and come to Lompoc and you'll have some really good sobriety. And, you know, we started sponsoring each other, and I remember, you know, the first step, I could do that pretty easy. My sponsor was like, you know, "It's pretty obvious that you're powerless, dude. Doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure that out." And we got to the second step, and I was like, "Oh no, this is where I stopped." You know, my mom ran away to Reno with the preacher. "I'm not doing this God thing." And he was like, "Look, stupid." He was a big guy too, tattoos and one of those prison looking guys. He says, "All you need to know about the second step is that there is a God, you're not it, and move on through the rest of the steps. When it's time, God will reveal himself to you. And you're going to pray and ask him in the morning to keep you sober that day, and you're going to say thanks at night." And when I was willing enough to follow that little bit of direction. And when I first started praying, I would be like sarcastic, "God, my sponsor's making me pray to you, and please keep me sober for today." And then at night I'd be like, "Yeah, thanks." But eventually with that repetition, it got less sarcastic and it got kind of like a quiet time where I would get centered in the morning before work. And then I would even hear, like, in the Muslim faith, they call the faithful to prayer in the morning with the muezzin, and they do this kind of this chant, and that used to be like calming to me. I was like, "That's cool," you know. So I was like, I was becoming this spiritual giant. And I did, you know, did that first 4 step, and it was just like this jumble autobiography, but, you know, it made me feel like I belonged when I started doing the steps. Because before, I would hear everybody, oh, we're doing this step, I'm on this step, and I didn't feel like I belonged here. And so I went through the steps, and our meetings were getting bigger. It got so big. When I left Lompoc after about 5 years, we had our meetings in the chapel, and there was like 100 guys. And we were like putting together time. Some of us had 5, 6, 7 years. And then for some reason, they want to kick me out of the maximum security penitentiary. I didn't want to leave. Mostly everybody's like, man, I can't wait to get out of here and get transferred to someplace that's a lower level security. But the AA was so great there, I didn't want to leave. But they made me. And they sent me to a brand new place that in Victorville, California, and it had nothing. No meetings, no nothing. And that's where I learned to depend on my higher power a little more instead of having to depend on the group. Because sometimes you can get in situations where that's all you got, you know. And you know what I did? I went to the administration and I started a meeting. And at first, nobody came, but I was there. I was talking. I was impressed with one of the young ladies back here, Carrie. She went and chaired a 5 a.m. meeting the other morning and got up at 4 in the morning after being up probably at the dance all night. Hey! And she says, yeah, I got up. I'm tired. I got up and chaired this meeting and nobody showed up. But you know what? You showed up. And that's our legacy, is that we always want the hand of AA to be there. No matter what. So, eventually people started showing up and, got some little meetings going, and I got some guys like New York Jimmy and Steve that would come in, some outside guests, and that meeting's still going today. Then I got transferred again. This was I had about 7 years sober at this time. Got transferred to Phoenix, FCI Phoenix, right up by Anthem. Little place, you really can't even tell it's there. A little oasis in the desert. And they had really good AA. There were some guys there that I was there with from Lompoc. My friend Shane, he just got out. Just barely got out. Been in there all his time. He's got 15 years sober. When he was in Lompoc, I found him worked in the paint shop, and he was all strung out and like sleeping under a cardboard box all day, hiding so he didn't have to work. He was there. Got 15 years sober now. Just got out. So, and that's where I met New York Jimmy and Steve Kay and Rex. And I was like, these guys are awesome. And, so I had about a year left. I called home. And that's why I'm glad that all the speakers this weekend have talked a little bit about, it's not all pink cloud here. Just because you're in recovery doesn't mean life doesn't stop happening, doesn't mean shit happens. And sometimes it's just a shitty place to be, like with your son. It's just, but the great news is that the people in the rooms will love you and walk you through this stuff. And you don't have to drink over it. So I called home, and my brother-in-law answered the phone, and he was just bawling. I was like, you know, what the hell is wrong with you? And he says, Janie's dead. And that was my niece, the one that took me to the first meeting. She put together 8 years and relapsed. Slipped, I like to call it. Sobriety lost its priority. And I didn't want to drink. I wanted to go to the meeting and be with my boys in there. And I sponsored a gentleman in there whose his name is Roots. He's from one of the tribes down by Tucson. He's still sober today. And Roots came by my cell. And he said, burn the sage and say a prayer for your niece. And I did that. And then I was going to go outside and go jogging. And this is one of the small God shots I've got being in this program. Actually, it was a big God shot. I went outside to go jogging. And when I walked outside, there was a big double rainbow. And it just gave me a feeling of peace that, that my niece was with God and she was okay, that she was okay. And now, every time I see a rainbow, I think of her. So, that was tough. And so, 2007, they kicked me out of there, and I went to a halfway house down in Phoenix. Never been to Phoenix before. They tried to tell me the next day, hey, you got to go to Task on 16th Street in Indian School. And I'm like, how do I even do this? I have been on the same little compound for years and years and years. And luckily, funny, my roommate there was in the program, a guy named Jason. He's like, hey, I had to go there the other day. You can go with me. And we rode the bus over to Task. That was like my first trip out into society after I did 11 years that time. And I was told by guys like Jimmy and Rex and Steve, get out and start going in the meetings. Get in the middle. I have a funny saying. I heard it from a drunk nun. She wasn't drunk at the time, but she was. And I tell all of the all you guys I've worked with, I work with young adults in treatment for a few years. I always like to tell them, remember, it's the banana that gets away from the bunch is the first one to get peeled. So stay in the middle of the herd. Teresa talked about it last night. So I did that. I got in the mix, started going to meetings, took a job shoveling dirt. But you know what? From learning to suit up and show up to meetings and for my recovery, that helped me to suit up and show up in the workforce. And I came up. I went to 9 years of education, K through 9. I got a GED in prison. You know, today I have a job I'm supposed to, my job I have is I'm supposed to have a degree. I'm a case manager at supposedly one of the three top treatment centers in the world down in Wickenburg. And I'm not supposed to have that. I have a level one fingerprint card to work with kids, like my man here was talking about. I had a job for a while. I was running a group home for kids that are taken by CPS that have been abused. And when I applied for that, they were like, what are you, stupid? You applying for a fingerprint card? You got two bank robbery convictions. You've been to state prison for forgery and burglary. And then you tried to kill somebody with a Pinto wagon. We're not giving you this. But I know people from in the program. I have friends who are cops, judges. I fly airplanes now, small airplanes. I have friends who are ex-airline pilots. They all, you know, put papers, letters for me. This guy deserves a chance. A guy like me is not supposed to be doing what I do today. And we were talking at the meeting last night about, or yesterday morning, luxury problems. I have luxury problems today. You know, I got to ride my Harley up here with my friend William back there. Luxury problem. And then, you know, I had to have my girl, the lovely Lisa, follow me up in my Lexus. Boy, my life is horrible. But you know what? If I took a drink today, all my problems would be solved. You know why? Because I would have a whole new set of horrible problems. That the stuff I have to deal with today would seem insignificant. So, my message is that it's not how you do on the mountaintops that's important. It's how you do in the valleys. And there's going to be valleys. It's just how life is. 3 years ago, my sister, my favorite sister, my niece's mom, she switched from heroin to alcohol after my niece died, and she could not deal with it. She had no coping skills, just like none of us. Our coping skills are to drink and use. And she got drunk down in Wickenburg and wanted to use the car. My brother-in-law said, "No way, you can't use the car like this." And she's like, "Screw you, then I'm going to hitchhike to Prescott." And she got out there on Highway 93 just outside of Wickenburg and was struck and killed by a truck. And thank God for this program, because I didn't have to drink and use. The people of this program carried me through that. I was able to be there for my poor mom, who's at that time was 80 years old. She's already lost one kid. She's lost a grandkid. And the hardest thing I ever had to do was to go to her that morning and tell her, "You've lost another kid to this disease." And I stayed up for 4 days. I had to come to Prescott to identify her body at the morgue. And then I got her cremated up in Flagstaff, and me and my buddy flew his plane up, and we got her ashes. And I mixed my niece's and my sister's ashes together in a brown paper bag, and we flew the airplane real slow by this mountain at my mom's house out in Aguila, and I held that bag out the window, and they're together again in the spirit. And that's a beautiful thing, to be able to be there for my mom. And I had to do a lot of work around the stuff with my mom, and I still have issues with her. And she's getting back at me now for all the crap I put her through. So about a year ago, my mom calls me up. She's like 82, and she's sounding funny, you know, goofy as hell. I'm like, "What the hell is wrong with you?" And she says, "Well, my neighbor Doc Jones won't give me any more pills." I'm like, "What are you talking about?" She goes, "Yeah, he's been giving me Xanax for the last 6 years." I was like, "Holy shit, Mom, you're one of us." And she has turned into the little dope fiend, quite the little dope fiend. She's convinced that, you know, we come from a nervous family and that she needs these because she has panic attacks and anxiety. And so, you know, she went to another doctor and they told her, "Oh, you only take one a day. You know, you'll be fine." And so she got her little script back. And but every time she starts running low, she starts panicking and freaking out. And she called me and told me, "Well, I was running out, but I found a couple under the bed." And I'm like, "Oh, so you're like the crack addict smoking the popcorn ceiling now?" Like, "Hey, that looks like a piece." And then she likes to chase it with a little brandy. So, but bless her heart, she's been through hell. She's 83. she knows what I do, you know, and she's proud of me today, and I that's my thing. I try to look out for my mom. You know, that's all I can do. We're the only example of the big book anybody else might ever see. So I try to remember that when I'm road ranging and, you know, I'll get you. I'll pass you. So that's what I try to do, is remember I'm the only example of the big book somebody else might ever see. And if I set a bad example, I might kill you, because you're not going to want what we have. So life is good today. It's 11:32. That's it for my little toaster story. How I burned the toast. But it's just been a fantastic weekend. You guys are incredible. I love you. And thank you.